More with Robbie Buck and Wendy Harmer
on ABC Radio Sydney.
You know, whenever we discuss drug policy on this program, there are really heavy reactions to it and really strong emotive reactions
it. And a lot of people, of course, a lot of the, what we get on the text line there is just say no.
Well, there is that too, but there's also, I mean, it's such a different, lots of different approaches to it. But the history of the war on drugs is, I wonder if you're aware of it, it's a really interesting thing. Anthony Lowenstein's book, Pills, Powder and Smoke, takes a look at that, but it also, of course, takes you across the globe to see where it is in 2019. Anthony, good morning.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Ah, wow. I have, this is a very personal interest of mine, Anthony, and I've read lots of books about the war on drugs, but in this one, you put your body on the line, you get out there. Tell us where you went and where you reported from and why you went there.
So in the last 5 years, I decided that I wanted to go on the front line and see what the drug war meant. I think it was partly because, I think for many people, if you mention the drug war, they might think Mexico. They might say, well, isn't it kind of winding down because, say, US states are legalizing pot, or Canada last year was the first Western country to legalize marijuana for recreational and medicinal purposes. And a lot of my work, I'm a sort of, I guess, a post 9/11 journalist. I started doing journalism professionally in 2003, and I'd covered many situations, the war in Afghanistan, the occupation of Palestine. But the drug war, for whatever reason, hadn't really come up. And in some ways, through my investigations in Honduras, Guinea-Bissau, and West Africa, Philippines, US, UK, Australia, I thought that this was a war that really in no other way is the most brutal war of the last half century, and in some ways still continues, many ways still continues, and in fact has never been more brutal than it is today.
Now, you start the book with a quote from one of Richard Nixon's key advisors. Do you want to read it? There it is.
I can.
Yeah. And I guess this starts opens the tenor for the book itself.
Indeed. Well, just in brief context, obviously, Richard Nixon, US president, declared a war on drugs in the early 70s. And this is one of his advisors who said decades later, quote, "You understand what I'm saying. We knew we couldn't make it illegal to be either against the war, Vietnam War, or black. But by getting the public to associate the hippies with marijuana and blacks with heroin, and then criminalizing both heavily, we could disrupt both communities. We could arrest their leaders, raid their homes, break up their meetings, and vilify them night after night on the evening news. Did we know we were lying about the drugs? Of course we did."
Okay, it's a pretty strong opening, and essentially you're saying that the war on drugs was started purely for political reasons as opposed to, health and social reasons.
Yes, in a word. And in fact, I mean, the drug war really goes further back than that. I talk about it in the book. In the US, really, it started off arguably 100 years or so before that, where a lot of Mexicans started coming to the US to do manual labor, as they still do, if they can get across Trump's border. And a lot of white Americans made the argument that they were bringing in pot to seduce white women. And that was seen as a threat, and therefore you had to crack down on both Hispanics and pot. In Australia, during the Chinese gold boom, there was a lot of white Australians who feared Chinese were using opium to seduce white women. There's a theme here. In many countries in the West, there's a similar kind of racial element. Fast forward to today, the racial element is central. It's not the only reason. I mean, the war on drugs has always been a war on the poor. So in all the places I went to, yes, you could be very rich selling drugs and be in jail. That's true. But the vast majority of people who are caught up in the drug war, killed in the drug war or incarcerated are poor, who have no voice, no influence or whatever it may be. And on any kind of metric, how does one judge the drug war a success? I mean, drug use is soaring. Australia's got one of the highest per capita drug uses in the world of illegal drugs, cocaine, heroin, methamphetamines, et cetera, cannabis, of course, alcohol, which is a legal drug, but that's obviously widely used as well. And in some ways, the violence associated with the drug war, which is what I wanted to look at from the source. So in Honduras, very briefly, a lot of the cocaine going into the US goes via Honduras from Colombia and Venezuela. And the reason many people are fleeing Honduras, particularly trying to get into now Trump's America, is for that very reason. The country is essentially a war zone.
How violent? You were there. How violent is it?
It's not Syria in the middle of a civil war violent, but it is violent. I mean, the murder rate there is one of the highest in the world outside traditional war zone. A lot of people I spoke to, I was in the major cities and the smaller towns, were saying there's something called a war tax there, where anyone who wants to start a business, from a taxi driver to a shop keeper, has to pay a war tax, so to speak, to one gang, two gang, three gangs. If you do not pay, you literally will be shot dead. Mm. It's just as simple as that. Mm-hmm. So the drug war is not the only reason there's violence there, but it's a key reason. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things people often don't realise, and I discuss this in the book, is if we, and I do, accept the fact that drugs are always going to be part of life, and it doesn't mean that we, in my view, encourage people to take coke or to use heroin. Far from it.
Yeah, but because this is at the, for a lot of our listeners as well, this is at the real crux of it, isn't it? Where you're saying, look, people are going to take drugs no matter what.
If you always have.
Always have, sure. But there are lots of people who will say, well, you know, I've had family members who have been really badly affected by drug use.
Definitely.
It's a big problem. We've seen the ICE inquiry at the moment. We know the devastation that that plays out because of drugs across Australia. And this is where the debate becomes very, very difficult.
It does. And let me give you an example then close to home. So the Safe Injecting Facility, which has been here in Sydney for about two decades, there's now one in Melbourne, obviously down south. And all the opposition to that, which came at the time from many politicians, many in the media, particularly the Murdoch press, but not only, were about the fact that opening these centres are going to encourage drug use, more people are going to die. In fact, the opposite has happened. Now, has everyone in Australia stopped using heroin? Of course they haven't. Will people still abuse drugs if heroin is legal? Yes, they'll still probably abuse drugs. But the way that we should look at it is nobody who's ever been in a safe injecting facility anywhere in the world has ever died. Not one. And yet, if you look at the death rate before the facility opened in Sydney or Melbourne, more people were dying. There's more problems on the street. So the issue that I argue, and I'm not the first one to say it, is that the idea maybe of legalizing drugs sounds like a radical idea. But to me, in fact, the prohibition of drugs, that's what's radical. What's killing a lot of, for example, kids last summer here in Sydney and in New South Wales with bad ecstasy pills is not the ecstasy. It's the chemicals that's in the drugs. So unless you actually know what's in the drug. Now, some parents might say, well, I don't want my kids taking drugs at all. Okay, I'm a parent. My child's very young. He's not taking drugs yet. But that to me is unrealistic and naive because kids, and older people too. In fact, the rates of drug use for older people is much higher than young people these days. Actually, the younger people are taking less drugs and drinking less. A legal and regulated drug system is in fact the most sane system because it actually minimizes harm and accepts the fact that this is a health issue. It's not a criminal justice issue, it's a health issue.
We're speaking with Anthony Lowenstein. He's based in Jerusalem, but you can hear by his accent there, he's an Aussie
I'm still
lad.
Australian, though, yes.
He's written for the New York Times, The Guardian, the BBC. You might have caught up with his book, Disaster Capitalism, Making a Killing Out of Catastrophe.
Another light read.
A brilliant one. Anthony, put this war in context for us. You say it's the most deadly war in modern times. How do you gauge that?
So a few different ways. Yep. One, think of the death toll. In Mexico, for example, at the moment, which obviously is experiencing the worst violence ever, in the first half of this year, the death rate was the worst on record. They started counting death tolls about 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. That's not solely from drugs, but it's a lot to do with drugs. Look at, say, Colombia. In the last 50 years, there obviously was a massive civil war there between the government and rebels. There was a peace deal in 2016, which sadly is now collapsing. But the death rate for that were hundreds of thousands of people. The people who have been killed or affected by the drug war in the last 50 years across the globe. Look at the US, another example. Every year at the moment, there are at least 70,000 people dying from some relation to opioids, legal and illegal drugs. And opioids, of course, are mostly legal, as they are here. Often they're badly misused. The reason I said it's the most deadly war is that it's not just a question of a death toll, which is incredibly high. It's the social effects of that war and the idea that we have governments that continually persist in pursuing a so-called war, including here in Australia, in New South Wales. The idea that at music festivals here still in 2019, the police dare to send police dogs into music festivals to try to stop, apparently, kids taking ecstasy pills when the effects of that can be very deadly. So many police that I spoke to, admittedly, they won't speak on the record,
yeah,
will say to you, not all, but most will say the same thing. We know it doesn't work.
Yeah,
it does not work. Yeah. So the question is, therefore, why are we still doing it?
Well, the answer, though, is political, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it is political.
And this is at the heart
of
all
this. And a gutlessness, I think, of politicians, yes.
I was reading the a report about the murder of a woman just the other day. And in it, it had the line there that it was believed that she had been dabbling in drugs. That immediately, it's interesting to me, that immediately says to us, I guess it's code for some kind of moral failing.
Indeed.
Still. And is that ever, are we ever going to get past that, do you think?
Well, I talk about
that. That is absolutely ingrained.
I mean, the language of how we talk about drugs, I really talk about that I acknowledge myself, and it was more done in an unthinking way rather than a pernicious way, that for many years I would sort of say, such and such, you know, he's an addict. It didn't mean that person was evil or should be in jail, but just we use that kind of language. And increasingly, for a lot of journalists, and this is more coming from the US and the UK, we're trying to change the way people can be addicted to drugs. I mean, addiction exists. I'm not denying that. But the way I think we demonize and make it a moral issue, that it's almost as if it's a moral failing if someone's on heroin or using cocaine or whatever. If that is true, then huge numbers of Australians are morally flawed. Now, if we actually believe that, then what should we do with those people? Should we lock them all up? Should we try to punish them? Should we cast them aside? And the truth is, because I think so many Australians and many people around the world are using these drugs, the moral argument, I think, falls away. And one of the things I argue in the book and I show is that, and again, this sounds like a radical idea maybe, but why can't we imagine the idea of an ethical use of cocaine? Mm-hmm. Now, I don't mean, to be clear, I'm encouraging people to use cocaine. I'm saying that if drug use is so high, mm-hmm, do we not want to think about where the drugs are coming from? At the moment, in much of the West, we're caring about where our food comes from, where our milk comes from, where our water comes from.
But, but people are going to say that is, you know, you're a radical. That's what they're going
to say. How about free trade? Well, maybe I am, but the idea of free trade, ethically sourced cocaine is not that radical, mm-hmm, because the Global Drug Survey, which is the world's biggest drug survey, 130,000 people every year being interviewed around the world about it, say, and this is from across the world, including here, that a drug like that is, in other words, it's acknowledging that these drugs exist. The issue with the danger of a drug like cocaine abuse is not that people suddenly are going to die from using a line. It's what's in these drugs.
Yeah.
So it's not it's what's radical to me is the current prohibitionist mindset.
Anthony, I guess the case or the experience that is pointed to across the globe is Portugal, because they are the only country in the world to essentially decriminalise drugs across the board. And there were predictions, of course, that would lead to a lot more drug addiction in Portugal. What has been the result?
So 2001, Portugal decriminalised all drugs, and it's important to note that the government that did that was not some radical left government. Actually, they were quite conservative. They did it because rates of HIV were the highest in Europe, and that was obviously mostly from bad use of needles. Fast forward now 20-odd years, and the effect has been amazing. It's not perfect. Rates of use across all ages of all drugs has gone down.
It's gone down,
hasn't it? Gone down across all drugs. Anyone can Google that very quickly, simply. The facts are clear. And so much of the money that would have been spent on law enforcement is now spent on education and health. Yeah. Some people are still going to abuse drugs for a range of reasons. And the bigger question, of course, is, to be very clear, I'm not saying legalize and regulate drugs, therefore all societal problems disappear. Obviously, there's a reason why so many people are taking drugs. I want to say one quick point, that increasingly we will see in our society, which is happening already illegally, but very much in reality, more and more people are using drugs like ecstasy, LSD and magic mushrooms for medical reasons. There is growing amounts of research, people can Google this very simply, that it's possible within 5 or 10 years you would go to a doctor and rather than say, I'm depressed, can I have antidepressants, which is already given out like candy here, far too often in my view, people would maybe have in controlled environments the use of these drugs. And the results are amazing. Not for everybody, for a lot of people. Drugs that we associated with maybe partying or whatever else can actually help people medically.
Sure.
And that's a measurably positive sign.
Just finally, Anthony, this is obviously a big contribution to the debate. You've been around the world. What do you think of the state of the debate here in Australia? Do you feel it's shifting or... going public forwards, opinion backwards.
Is shifting. Public opinion is shifting. The studies and polls show that. Mm-hmm. Look, federally, I think it's inevitable that marijuana will be made legal. It's not going to happen tomorrow. Mm-hmm. It's hard to imagine happening with a Liberal Prime Minister such as Scott Morrison, who's definitely very much against it. There are certainly moves in places like the UK. Again, it won't happen maybe with Boris Johnson as Prime Minister, but it's inevitability that marijuana would be the first step.
Yeah, I know they just decriminalised it in New York City.
Yeah, look, in parts of the US, yeah. I mean, again, I think what will happen in the US, it's hard to see it happening with Trump as president, but I think it's important to note that when you have now in for the 2020 US election, which was not the case in 2016, the key leading Democratic candidates are openly talking about legalising marijuana, mm-hmm. reparations for people who have suffered from the war on drugs, and actually using that money to help communities that have suffered because of it. And Australia, and especially New South Wales, sadly and profoundly ignorantly, we have a leadership here led by Gladys Berejiklian, who is seemingly blind to evidence. Pill testing, as an example, doesn't solve societal problems, but pill testing everywhere in the world, US, UK, Canberra, has shown that pill testing saves lives. Drugs that are bad are taken out of circulation. And a lot of police you speak to, who are often the ones prosecuting these poor kids and judges, they know that. They say that. So it's political will.
All right. Okay. All right. It is a fascinating read, and it's going to certainly create some strong opinions. Pills, Powder and Smoke Inside the Bloody War on Drugs is the name of the book. Anthony Lowenstein is the journalist behind it. 5 years travelling around the world putting the book together. Thanks very much for coming in this morning.
Thanks so much for having me, guys.
Great reviews here too. Christos Solkis saying meticulous and forensic and also impassioned and urgent. This book is vital and I couldn't put it down.
It was very nice of Christos. Thank you. He wasn't paid for that.
Thank you.